Kashmir so that Pakistan can focus on the militants. Can you talk about it as being a flashpoint and what you think needs to be done there?
Well, I think, you know, unfortunately, the thing about Kashmir is that India and Pakistan act as though Kashmir is a problem. But really, for them both, Kashmir is a solution. You know, Kashmir is where they play their dirty games. And they don't want to solve it, because whenever they have, you know, internal problems, they can always pull this bunny out of the hat. So I really think that these two countries are not going to solve it, you know. And what is happening is that there is a population of people who have been suffering untold misery for so many years, you know. And once again, so many lies have been told about it. The Indian media is just the falsification that's it's involved with about Kashmir is unbelievable. Like 2 years ago, was it last year? 2 years ago, there was a massive uprising in Kashmir. I happened to be there at the time. I've never seen anything like this, you know. There were millions of people on the street all the time. And
they were rising up for...
They were rising up for independence. You know, they were rising up for independence. And then that uprising was, you know, when they rose up with arms, that was wrong. When they rose up without arms, that was wrong too. And the way it was diffused was with an election. An election was called. And then everybody was shocked because there was a huge turnout in the elections. And all the, you know, we have many election experts in India who spend all their time in television studios analyzing the swing and this and that. But nobody said that all the leaders of the resistance were arrested. Nobody asked, what does it mean to have elections when there's 700,000 soldiers supervising every 5 meters all the time, all year round? They don't have to push people on the end of a bayonet to the voting booth, you know. Nobody talked about the fact that there was a lockdown in every constituency. Nobody wondered what does it mean to people who are under that kind of occupation. The fact that they need somebody to go to, you know, when someone disappears, or, you know, they need some representative. So now, once again, the violence has started, you know. This is a permanent sort of cycle where, in the interests of geopolitical jockeying, any sense of morality is missing. And of course, it's very fashionable to say that, you know, there isn't any morality involved in international diplomacy. But suddenly, when it comes to Maoist killing, you know, morality just comes riding down on your head, you know. So people use it when they want to.
And Arundhati, in both India and the United States, as these wars expand, as the military occupations, as you delineated in Kashmir, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, as they expand, what is your message to anti-war activists, to peace activists around the world, here and in India? What do you think people need to be doing?
See, I think I just want to say one thing more, which is that in Kashmir, you have, as I said, 700,000 soldiers who have been turned into an administrative police force. In India, where they don't want to openly declare war against the Adivasis, you have a paramilitary police which is being trained to be an army. So the police are turning into the army, the army is turning into the police. But to push through this growth rate, you know, you have basically this whole country is turning into a police state. And if I just want to say one thing about democracy, you know, in India, the elections they cost more than the American elections, much more. This poor country cost much more. The most enthusiastic were the corporates. The members of parliament are, a majority of them are millionaires. If you look at the statistics, actually this big majority, it has 10% of the vote. The BBC had a campaign where they had posters of a dollar bill, $500 bill, sort of molting into a Indian 500 rupee note with Ben Franklin on one end and Gandhi on the other. And it said, Kya India ka vote badlega dunya ka note? Meaning, will the Indian vote save the market? You know, so voters become consumers. It's a kind of scam that's going on. So the first message I would have to peace activists is, I don't know what that means anyway. What does peace mean? You know, we may not need peace in this unjust society, because that's a way of accepting injustice, you know. So what you need is people who are prepared to resist, but not just on a weekend, not just saying, okay, we'll march on Saturday and maybe they'll stop the war in Iraq. But in countries like India, now people are really paying with their lives, with their freedom, with everything. I mean, it's resistance with consequences now. You know, it cannot be something that has no consequences. You know, it may not have, but you've got to understand that in order to change something, you've got to take some risks now. You've got to come out and lay those dreams on the line now. You know, because things have come to a very, very bad place there.
Arundhati Roy, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Her latest book is called Field Notes on Democracy, Listening to Grasshoppers. I look forward to being with you and Noam Chomsky in Cambridge in a week. I'm Amy Goodman with Anjali Kamat. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 8:01. Coming up next, it's More Talk Radio. Hosts Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott talk with Dar Jamal, independent journalist and author of The Will to Resist.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
Good morning. You are listening to More Talk Radio on KBOO. This is Cecil Prescott, and we welcome you on this Monday, March 22nd, 2010. Before we begin our program this morning, let me invite you to a special presentation on Afghanistan by Dana Vasali, which will be held on March 22nd, 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House, which is located at 4312 Southeast Stark Avenue. It will be a presentation on Afghanistan. Dana Vasali is a botanist and naturalist with a long-standing concern about the impact of modern warfare on human society and on the natural world. And he has just returned from Afghanistan. That takes place this evening, 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House. And we welcome you and thank you for joining us and being a part of our conversation this morning. Joining us this morning is the journalist Dar Jamel, who has reported on the war in Iraq for these many years. At a time when many Americans have lost interest or concern about what is happening in the region, our guest this morning reminds us that we continue to the U.S. continues to play a terribly important role there. A few years ago, he wrote these words, which are challenging to all of us. He wrote, it was a failure of citizenship of the American people that the Bush cabal was allowed to invade Iraq. Thus, every U.S. citizen who is not doing everything in their power to end this illegal and immoral occupation as quickly as possible is complicit with the war crimes being committed in Iraq on a daily basis. That is a reminder for not only the Bush administration, but I imagine for the U.S. administration that is under Barack Obama. Joining us this morning is Dar Jamel, and we thank you for your presence here with us this morning, and we're looking forward to your presence here in Portland in a few weeks. Good morning.
April 10th, I believe.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning.
Well, thank you for joining us. And just to allow our listeners to know that you will be a part of a presentation with the Physicians for Social Responsibility on April 10th here in Portland. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you will be a part of their annual event and for something that's a little bit different in which we celebrate. This is an opportunity when PSR will celebrate students who have written essays on peace, and there will be an award presented, and you will be a guest speaker at that event. And we look forward to that event and looking forward to encouraging the next generation of journalists and activists who are advocating for peace and truth speaking.
Well, not just journalists and activists, but actually everyone. And since we have Physicians for Social Responsibility sponsoring this, we hope it extends to the medical community as well. But first and foremost, I know that a lot of your recent articles have been on the health effects of the war, both here in the United States as well as in Iraq, and especially in villages like Fallujah. Can you tell me how you connected with Physicians for Social Responsibility to come here to Portland to speak?
Well, I was invited to speak there in the wake of a talk I gave at a Physicians for Social Responsibility meeting up in Seattle for the Washington chapter of that group. And there I focused specifically on a lot of people don't really make the direct, and I think it's a very overt link of health effects of war and what's happening, that pertaining to both soldiers and the people on the ground of the countries that the U.S. is invading and occupying. So in that particular talk, I spoke at length of the effects on U.S. soldiers, things like post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury from roadside bombs and when they come back home and can't get their benefits and the depression and all this sort of thing. And I will talk about that in Portland as well, but I'll also focus much more on health effects of, for example, the Iraqi people, because the U.S. has used so much depleted uranium munitions in both Iraq and Afghanistan, but I'm focusing specifically on Iraq, and they've used so much in Iraq that it's affecting Iraqis in a heinous way. I mean, we're seeing cancer rates increasing by 1,000% in some of these places where they've been using it, in places like Fallujah, where they used so much DU during the sieges in 2004 of that city that actually we're having imams starting to advise women not to have babies anymore, that it's gotten that bad.
It's been a traumatic effect, right.
Right, and simultaneously we're seeing soldiers come back home who've been exposed to DU, and then their wives get pregnant, and then they're having some of the same birth defects and abnormalities as the Iraqi babies.
Well, let us start with some of the health concerns that we saw initially. One of the biggest concerns had been the fact that you had civilians appearing with very serious burns. And so there were arguments and a difficulty on the part of the United States to even admit that he was using white phosphorus, which was the cause of many of the civilian burns. Is that one of your initial issues that you saw within the war?
Well, that's exactly right. Well back in the November 2004 U.S. siege of Fallujah, this was the really big siege, I actually broke the story of the U.S. using some sort of an incendiary weapon inside that city about a week into the siege. We didn't know enough to know that it was white phosphorus. Iraqis were calling it napalm, but we knew for sure that people were being hit by an incendiary weapon that would burn them all the way down to the bone. Putting water on it would not put it out. And they were using it so much that Iraqis actually had ample opportunity through trial and error to figure out, well, if they applied damp mud to it, that would at least slow it down almost to a stop. Doctors were reporting this to me as well. And then when the story came out, of course, you know, the typical government response, the military denied it up and down. And it wasn't until a year later when an Italian television station, Rai TV, ran a documentary about the U.S. using banned weapons in Fallujah, that forced the Pentagon to address the issue. And we applied the heat and wrote several more articles, and they actually did finally admit to using white phosphorus in Fallujah. And what's particularly egregious about this is, aside from the fact of how heinous this type of weapon actually is and its effects on humans, is that according to the Geneva Conventions, while it's not a banned weapon, it is there are strict regulations around where it's allowed to be used. And under the Geneva Conventions, it's not allowed to be used in an area where they're suspected to be civilians. And even according to the Pentagon, during the November siege, there were between 30 and 50,000 civilians who chose to stay inside that city. So by the Pentagon's own admission, both of that and the fact that they did use this weapon, they did violate the Geneva Convention.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city, 91.9 if you are in Hood River. In the Gorge, it's 100.7. On the web, online, KBOO is www.kboo.fm. This is More Talk Radio with myself, Celeste Carey, and my co-host, Cecil Prescott. We're speaking with Dar Dermal, and we're talking about the health effects within Iraq of the war and how that's going to affect the next generation, possibly a couple of generations to come.
I'm continuing our conversation. Certainly you were one of the first journalists who were reporting unoccupied by U.S. forces in the war zone.
Unembeddedly, as a matter of fact.
And so as you were initially one of those who first reported for many of us, the fact has remained, and you've written recently, that for many Americans, the war has fallen off of our concerns, off of things that we are talking about. As this Obama administration begins a focus on Afghanistan and begin a withdrawal from Iraq, are there continuing issues that you continue to write about that we should be aware of? I'm thinking in particular some recent articles you've written about the role of women, for example, and the new government. So perhaps I can begin by asking you for some of your observations on recent events in Iraq, particularly looking at the elections. So what is it that we are not aware of that you can share with our audience?
Well, I think the first and most important thing is that there is not going to be a U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. There is a common misperception, thanks to propaganda from the Obama administration, and then this put out widely by most of the corporate media, that the U.S. is basically involved right now in a drawdown that's going to ultimately result in, by the end of 2011, a complete withdrawal of all forces from that country, and this couldn't be further from the truth. They are, in fact, drawing down troops, mostly to redeploy them almost immediately over to Afghanistan, but by Obama's own admission in a speech he gave in Chicago back in November 2006, he fully intends to keep a strike force of a minimum of 50,000 troops in that country well beyond the end of his first term. So, and then that coupled with when we look at the base infrastructure and the embassy that the U.S. has built there, that's already the size of Vatican City and about to be doubled in size, that there's really nothing to indicate a total U.S. withdrawal from that country. Because when you look at the facts on the ground and consider that the U.S. has pumped tens of billions of dollars into building up a massive infrastructure of at least five what they call enduring bases in that country, one of them with the busiest runway in the entire Department of Defense base system. That means that over 6,000 bases worldwide, including all of those inside the United States, this is the single busiest runway in that entire network. The fact is the U.S. is not going to be handing these bases over for Iraqi control, I would argue, ever, not until they decide that they have an effective enough client government in that country that they would be able to withdraw and stay out of it in a way that they have, for example, in a place like Egypt. But they're a long, long way from that by their own admission. So that's I think, the first and foremost thing that people need to understand is that the U.S. has no plans of a total withdrawal from Iraq.
Well, Dar, can we explore that a little bit more? Because you said two things that I think are really, really important. One is a buildup of infrastructure of the U.S. base, and contrast it with the fact that the infrastructure within Iraq is still seriously lacking, to the point that people still don't have electricity as fully as they have. I mean, and some of the places they have electricity, and some it's considered good that you might have it for 6 hours or so a day. So here we have lots of infrastructure in the U.S. Areas. And then second, you mentioned the fact that the troops will not be withdrawn anytime soon. And I understand the big issue right now, besides stop loss, is the remissioning of U.S. troops in Iraq to continue to occupy beyond the August 2010 deadline.
Well, that's exactly right. And then I think that's an important point that you make, to contrast the amount of money and effort being put into sustaining and increasing the U.S. infrastructure inside Iraq. Meanwhile, Iraqi infrastructure is in total shambles. So despite there's been more than $150 billion earmarked for so-called reconstruction projects in that country. And that, of course, we have to consider alongside the fact that Iraq, according to a group called Transparency International, just released a report that put Iraq in the top five most corrupt countries on the planet. So that's one of the reasons why, and that's corrupt both on the Iraqi side and, of course, the U.S. side. You know, think of it as kind of a slow-motion bailout for weapons manufacturer companies and companies like Halliburton and KBR and Bechtel and numerous others that we can go down a list. I mean, today as we speak, there's still more than 600 Western contractors operating inside of Iraq, and yet Iraqis, two out of three Iraqis do not have access to safe drinking water. The average amount of electricity in a home in Iraq is maybe between 4 and 6 hours per day, given on any particular day. And then we have unemployment rates there still that make those that we had in this country during the Great Depression look favorable. It's really a staggering situation. That it's another thing that I think a lot of people don't understand. A lot of people do assume, well, it's been 7 years, at least something's gotten better. Mm-hmm. We still have nearly 5 million people in that country who are displaced from their homes, both inside the country and outside. So it's really a staggering situation that continues, and it's all a byproduct of the occupation itself.
Well, let's explore a little bit more in terms of that occupation, particularly U.S. intentions and the role of the Iraqi authorities. Specifically, could you say something more about the U.S. long-term interest in creating building up this client state?
Well, absolutely. You know, Iraq, long before the Iraq War happened, the U.S. was forced to pull its bases out of Saudi Arabia because they were stoking the fires of anti-American sentiment there, because, you know, they were too close to, most people in that country believe they were too close to Mecca and other factors like this. And so the U.S. pulled them out and clearly needed another beachhead in Iraq. Many high-ranking people in the DOD were speaking of this at that time. And then Iraq, you know, of course, when the events of September 11 occurred in this country, immediate attention, even by Don Rumsfeld, then Secretary of Defense, turned immediately to Iraq, saying, you know, Saddam Hussein was responsible for this. we need to find a way to make sure that we can pin this on Iraq. And that's exactly what they did. So there was this little Afghanistan invasion, and then immediately they turned their sights to Iraq. And this is specifically because Iraq, you know, we're in an era of dwindling natural resources, and Iraq sits on the second largest known oil reserves on the planet. And it's basically a race as the U.S. is battling other rising empires, people like Russia, China, the EU, India. It was a race to get control of that oil. And there were other interests involved as well. It was in Israeli interest for the U.S. to invade Iraq. That played a factor. And it's certainly the Department of Defense for their own geostrategic positioning of more bases deep in the heart of the Middle East. That was another huge factor. But oil can't be discounted. The U.S. now is sitting in control of that country. So not that they want to start extracting all the oil as quickly as possible. That's not the goal, because the longer they wait, the more valuable that oil becomes. And they'll be the people sitting on it, and they'll be the people able to play a large role in determining the price, as well as that fact alone has served as a very effective counterbalance for the U.S. Against OPEC. So there can't ever be a huge threat of like what happened here in the 70s when we had the oil shortage because of what OPEC was able to do. Well, this invasion and the occupation of Iraq has effectively neutered OPEC in regards to how much power it would have over the U.S. So all of these factors played a big role, and now we have the U.S. that, you know, you could, on your more cynical days, I think, argue that as far as U.S. policy goes of wanting to control the oil, the shipping areas of the oil, have better geostrategic positioning of the military deep inside the Middle East, in all these ways, it has and is a success for U.S. policy.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, More Talk Radio. We're speaking with Arthur Dar Jamal. You're welcome to join in the conversation by dialing 503-231-8187. And we have a few callers who have been very patient with us and are waiting online in the buffer. Good morning, Tim. You're on the line.
Thank you very much for taking my call. And I just want to give a shout-out to Dar Jamal, who's been doing this work for a real long time. And it's been a long, difficult struggle, and it just seems to be getting more difficult. The specific reason I'm calling is that there is still some kind of Iraqi solidarity work going on in Portland. There's going to be an event this Saturday, Bike Ride for Iraq. We will join us for a benefit for Iraqi refugees in protest against the illegal American occupation of Iraq and crimes against the Iraqi people. It'll be a bike ride. We're going to be starting at the East Bank Esplanade near the Vera Cat statue. We'll be gathering there at about from 11 to 2, and then we'll be riding down the Springwater Corridor to Selwood, and there'll be a potluck event at the Selwood Community Center at 15th and Southeast Spokane, where people will have an opportunity to actually meet some of the Iraqi refugees that are coming into Portland. Right now we have about 200 families that have arrived in Portland from various parts of Iraq, and we're really fortunate that there's one woman, Zahara Al-Kabi, who is an actual activist, an Iraqi activist, who super articulate, super impressive fighter for the rights of the Iraqi refugees, as well as for Iraq in general. So that's going to be this Saturday, and everyone's welcome, and we're hoping to raise some money at the potluck for helping the refugees who, of course, are arriving in Portland, and there are no jobs in Portland, and so they're even here in very desperate straits.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Tim, for your call and for keeping the information before us.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Jamal, our caller reminded us of the continuing impact of the war on families and individuals. Before we go to our next caller, I was wondering if you could say something more about the continuing impact that the war has on families and particularly displaced individuals.
Well, it is ongoing. I think that's the most important thing on this topic that people need to understand. That, you know, it's easy to think that, well, after 7 years, something must be a bit better and Iraqis are going back home. But, you know, the country is still war-torn. There's a large level of violence happening there daily. I mean, we're still seeing anywhere from 3 people to 3 or 5 dozen every single day being killed. We're still seeing American troops being killed there every single week. You know, and as I mentioned earlier, we have the most conservative figure I've seen recently is 4.8 million Iraqis are displaced from their homes, both inside the country and outside. And then another distressing factor we have to consider is that when we look at the about 1.5 million Iraqis in Syria, the UN conducted a poll to those there and found out that of those surveyed, more than 90% never intended to go back home. We still see anyone who has any means available to them to make it possible leaving the country with no intentions to come back. This does not bode well for Iraq's future. And then, if I may go on a little bit of a tangent, we've seen Iraq go from one of the highest literacy rates in the world down to it's now far below 60%, and that's all also directly because of this started to happen after the invasion and occupation of the U.S. Began. So all of these combined are, you know, they're ongoing, massive, big problems with really negative ramifications for the future of Iraq.
Well, when you say negative ramifications, you know, I don't wish to sound as though I'm full of hyperbole, but what we're looking at is devastation for a couple of generations. For one, if what I'm reading and what I'm hearing is correct, you've got problems with the fact that people who've been displaced will not come back. You also have women who have been displaced who are fearful for their personal safety and their health care, especially if they're in childbirth, not wanting to come back or not have babies. And then you have the fact that you've had much of the middle class and the intellectual class killed off as well. And so you've got what could really reduce Iraq to a state that will keep it helpless for generations to come and not able to control any aspect of its own government. My question is, with the election that it had, how representative of the people who are activists in their country were the results of that election?
Well, the election, the short answer is none. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to be real clear about this election. This was between two U.S.-backed stooges. Prime Minister Maliki was not elected prime minister in the first place in any democratic way. He was inserted by the Bush and Blair administrations in April 06. The elected prime minister after the January 2005 national elections, the first ones in that country, was Ibrahim al-Jafari. Well, he wasn't exactly towing the U.S.-UK line, so he was basically given the boot, and Nouri al-Maliki was inserted by the Bush and Blair administrations. And then when we look over the aisle at his opponent in the election, Iyad Alawi, this is the former interim prime minister who's openly admitted to being a CIA asset, along as being involved with at least 10 intelligence agencies of other countries as well. So those are the two choices that the people of Iraq have. They're experiencing a lesser of two evil thing as we do here as well. So it's really not a situation that's benefiting them. The one light thing we could see about this election is the Iraqis have had enough of the religious fundamentalism that has been promoted in that country under Nouri al-Maliki, because Maliki is head of the Dawa Party, a very, very conservative Islamic political party. And yet, people are fed up with that. They're fed up with fatwas from imams telling them to do this or don't do that. And so that's why Iyad Alawi is making a strong showing in this election. But at the same time, both of these guys, Alawi did it when he was interim prime minister, and Maliki has certainly done it. They basically are ruling Iraq as Saddam did. Saddam, let's keep in mind, for most of his tenure as dictator, was heavily backed by the U.S., particularly during his worst excesses of violence, as has been Maliki and as has been Alawi, and those are the two leading candidates.
So this is, it seems to be the U.S. continuing a policy that it has maintained over decades We're speaking this morning with Dar Jamal, who is an independent journalist and author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unabetted Journalist in Occupied Iraq, and The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. Mr. Jamal will be in Portland April 10th for an event with the Physicians for Social Responsibilities. We invite your calls and comments, and we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, caller.
Good morning. I'll try and be brief, but, you know, this is all a kind of duh if you've been following, if you follow world affairs at all. I mean, if the U.S. intends to leave, why the hell did they build the biggest embassy in the world? It's called the Green Zone, of course, but why, I mean, that wasn't planned in a day. It takes a long time to get your architects and your engineers and your planning together. I mean, even before, this must have started before the war. So, you know, if they were intending to leave, there is, you know, this fact by itself belies any intentions of complete clearance of U.S. presence. And I don't know, you know, the United States of amnesia, you know, theory kicks in. I mean, how quickly people forget. I bet most people don't even think about that, but it's common sense, you know. And also, I think the only way you're going to get any attention paid to Iraq in any significant way again, because people, as I say, tend to forget so quickly because they're sitting at home watching it, or watching what they're fed, and they're not fed very much, is to take Bush, Blair, Cheney, and the whole crowd to The Hague in chains and make a public... I mean, I think the world would get behind that, you know, not the U.S. press, of course, which I have pretty close to utter contempt for, except for the alternatives like this station and, thank goodness, many others. So I'd like to comment, I'd like the your guest, Mr. Jamal, to comment on when does he think the actual planning of the Green Zone, the biggest embassy in the world, started. And it must have been, I'm a semi-retired architect and I know how long these things take. So I'd really like to see what his comments are on that and how it belies any kind of intent to leave anytime.
Great. Thank you, Carla.
Well, I think that's a really important point. I think both the so-called embassy, and I say so-called because I've seen this thing, and it is an absolutely massive, sprawling compound. And just for context, for listeners, it sounds like the caller's aware of it, but in case people aren't aware, this is an embassy that's the size of the Vatican City. Another size comparison is it's 2/3 the area of the National Mall in Washington, D.C. All the walls of the buildings are reinforced 2.5 times to be able to withstand airstrikes and other types of attacks. It has 2 helipads. It has its own gymnasium, yoga studios, shopping complexes, a school for the children of the diplomats, U.S. so-called diplomats who would work in this, will work in this compound. Its annual operating budget is $1 billion and increasing by the month. And then, as I mentioned earlier, briefly, the current head of the U.S. mission of the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad in January told reporters that they've requested enough funds from Congress that if they get these funds, he fully intends to double the size of the embassy. So double everything I just said. And, you know, he says this, he couches this, and I can't help but laugh because he says, you know, if we get the funds, well, how many times has anyone in Iraq related to the occupation requested funds from Congress and they didn't get them? It's never happened, not once, and it won't happen. So, and specifically, when did this thing start being planned? I mean, just think of this infrastructure I just described. And this is a massive, massive project. As he said, this is the largest diplomatic compound of any country anywhere on the planet. So clearly, years and years and years in advance, you know, and then, of course, we have to have the bidding process and all of this before.
Well, if we had a bidding process.
Well, that this is true, too. They a lot of the times they'll at least have them, you know, for show. But my point is, you know, several years in advance, I think, would be, you know, a conservative thing to put, that, you know, that along with the base infrastructure that I mentioned earlier, you know, this has long been the goal of the U.S. In Iraq for certainly years in advance of the invasion.
We're speaking with Dal Jamal, who is an independent journalist, and we'll talk more about that and his role and his reflection on the state of journalism. But first, let's go to a listener who's on the line. Good morning, caller. Thank you.
Good morning, caller.
First of all, Mr. Jamal, I have to tell you how much I admire your work. Your article in Extra magazine, March 2, 2010, the Manu Forgotten War, was extremely informative and very, very concise, and thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
And can we talk about the role of the mercenaries in the wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq? We know that the mercenaries are committing atrocities, you know, Blackwater and the 17 people that they murdered for apparently no reason. And can you talk about the expanding role of Blackwater, et cetera, and its impact? And I will take my answers off the air. Thank you so much. Have a lovely day.
Yeah, thank you, and really important question. That's actually a key element of this so-called U.S. drawdown of troops and a continuance of the occupation, where we're basically watching the majority of the occupation be privatized. We have far more contractors in Iraq today than we have U.S. forces. The current number of U.S. military personnel in Iraq, the admitted number, is somewhere between 96 and 98,000, and yet we have far more contractors. The most conservative number I found that's in that article that he mentioned is 114,000. Since Barack Obama took office, we've seen a 25% increase in contractors in Iraq and a 29% increase in contractors in Afghanistan. So we're seeing a massive effort to escalate the privatization of both of these occupations. One of the key reasons is that the military is severely overstretched. So, you know, instead of having troops going in for their fifth and sixth deployments to either occupation, they're slowly but surely replacing them with private contractors. So it's a very scary thing, because then we get into private contractors, it's harder to track how much money these folks are being paid out of U.S. taxpayer dollars. And of course, these people don't have to abide by any of the Geneva Conventions or the international laws that the U.S. military, even though, of course, they break them on a regular basis, at least technically they are subject to them, whereas these private contractors are not.
We're speaking with Dal Jamal, who is an independent journalist. Our last caller mentioned a recent article he wrote, The New Forgotten War, which is in the March 15th issue of Extra, the magazine of Fear. I would commend that article to all listeners. I was wondering, Mr. Jamal, as you continue to report on Iraq and the U.S. role there, your reflection on the state of journalism generally. It seems to be, in terms of corporate journalism, many have moved away from one doing very serious investigative reporting, but also been distracted. First, in your conversation with journalists who are more corporately controlled, are they aware of what's happening? Are they feel unable to report these truths, or are they forced to move on?
Well, I don't talk to them. I don't have a desire to talk to them, and I certainly don't have a need. I affiliate more with foreign journalists and independent journalists, because they tend to actually have real contacts on the ground, and we can work together and help facilitate one another's efforts, whereas corporate journalists, you know, it's not going to make any sense for me to go talk to somebody who's literally never left the green zone. I'm not going to get a good idea on stories or contacts for particular stories. I think the state of journalism in this country, when we look at the corporate media, it's abysmal. It's the worst it's ever been. I've talked about in lectures that, you know, we're looking at a media that's operating like a dinosaur and is dying. And I think our job is to help it die. I think it deserves to die. And I think that what poses as journalism in this country, you look at the CNNs and, you know, the Fox and all the other major networks, with few exceptions aside of journalists working in those media, they are basically little more than state stenographers. There's no critique. You know, everything that I'm talking about here, talking about U.S. foreign policy and bases and long-term plans and how much planning went into this invasion of Iraq long before it was even launched, and the catastrophic effect on all the people involved on the Iraqi side and Afghanistan and in the U.S. military as well as the U.S. taxpayer, you know, all of this should be a mainstream news. You know, people absolutely need to understand what's going on, how their tax dollars are being spent, and what is specifically U.S. foreign policy. And yet most people are largely ignorant of all this stuff that we're talking about today, and I hold responsibility for that clearly on the U.S. mainstream media. So I think, you know, that the media is, you know, I think it's at a point where, you know, it's like the government itself. Reform is, we've long since passed the point of reform, and I think we simply need to build a new one that actually functions. And thankfully, we have a vibrant alternative media in this country, as evidenced by stations like Democracy Now! And your show here, that thankfully we have these other sources that we can turn to get the information that we need.
So a couple of questions. And first, so what do you think is affecting what I'll call the soul of the journalist? I'm kind of old school. I went to journalism school back in the 70s. And the idea was you had a duty to the American public to get this information out, to dig, to not gloss over things, to actually go for the controlling principles, the controlling players, whatever the roots were. You were supposed to go down and dig them out and try to the best of your ability, which you honed, to illustrate what was going on in any given situation. Nowadays, there seems to be more of a clever snarkiness that rules a lot of the corporate media, as if though no one has a soul, no one has a concern about writing anything even remotely readable or educated. Has the soul of journalism died?
Well, I think in journalists in the mainstream, for the most part, it has. And I think that snarkiness that you referred to is because journalists understand, and you know, a lot of this was ramped up under the Bush administration, but it certainly continues today, is that people understood really clearly, or they were taught to understand by the powers that be, that if you want access to us, you damn well better not be critical of us, that you need to basically give, at the very least, kind of light-handed reporting and you know, ideally, supportive reporting. And so that's what we've seen. And so, you know, the Helen Thomas in the front row of the presidential press conferences has moved to the back row, and Fox has given her seat. And that is, I think, really symbolic of what has happened, to where, you know, people who are more than happy to kind of get on the stages and dance with Karl Rove at certain meetings, as happened with a lot of major national-level journalists, you know, they're basically given favor and given access. And people like me or other colleagues of mine on the Hill, you know, there's no chance in hell that we're going to get access to interview some of these people, because they know the questions that we would ask them. So that's been a big part of it. So that's why you have journalists that basically wear kid gloves when they're going to interview the president or a particular senator or congressperson. They're the ones that are going to get access, not those of us who are going to actually ask the tough questions.
And I guess my next question is, are they wearing kid gloves, or are they just not sharp enough to really know how to maneuver their way around some of these overt barriers? A very intelligent person and good writer such as yourself knows how to phrase things in such a way that is not overtly threatening, and it shows the evidence of intelligence. Whereas some of the journalists that we see, even at the height of their sarcasm or snarkiness or whatever their calling how they write, they don't really evidence any deep insight in any way of being able to maneuver themselves into the story and discuss it without raising hackles overtly.
Well, that's a good point. And I think, and I'm just theorizing here, I might be a little bit off, but I would suspect that, you know, if you're a mainstream journalist and you're working in the media and your job is to basically consistently dumb down information and down to the lowest common denominator and talk to a viewing public as though they're in the sixth grade, which, you know, I've seen statistics that back that. That's the level of intelligence that the corporate media is operating at, that I would think eventually, you know, that would bleed off on you and you would kind of start thinking along those lines as well, thinking, well, I have access and I know what's best and I'm in a position where I can choose what these people can see and not see, and so I'm important and that gives me basically free rein to make those kinds of decisions. And so I think that inevitably affects people and they start actually believing this nonsense, and they start actually believing that they have, you know, ultimate power, and it's their job. They're kind of the gatekeepers of this type of information, and really the liaison between the average person and those in power. And they effectively, therefore, completely subverted the whole point of having a free press, which is, you know, it's our job. You know, we were theoretically to have a special access and special protections under the Constitution to go in and access these people to show the voting public what the people they elected are doing specifically so that the voting public can then decide, do we want to keep this person or do we want to impeach them or do we want to vote for somebody else in the next election? I mean, that is supposed to be the role of the press. You know, Amira Haas, a fantastic Israeli journalist who's basically dedicated her life to covering Israeli oppression of Palestinians in the occupied territories, said it best. She said, our job as journalists is to monitor the centers of power. So compare that ideal to what, say, Anderson Cooper does.
We're speaking this morning with Jah Jamal, who is an award-winning freelance journalist. His reporting from Iraq has earned him numerous awards, including the prestigious 2008 Martha Gellhorn Award for Journalism and the James Arison Award for Social Justice Journalism. Mr. Jamal will be in Portland on April 10th for an event sponsored by Physicians for Social Responsibility. As we continue our conversation, let me remind you that you are listening to KBOO at 9 on the Omo Variety Hour, a look at the new book, The Queer Imagination. Also in an interview with Annie Leonard, author of The Story of Stuff, How Consumer Culture is Devastating Communities and What We Can Do About It and More. At 10 on Air Cascadia, the guest is Dana Vasali, a botanist and naturalist, who just returned from Afghanistan and is speaking at the Friends Meeting House on Monday evening. At 10:15 on Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein, listen to Scott Burns, a geologist with Portland State University, about earthquakes. At 11 on Sound of Awareness, host Paul Van Dyke speak with Chris Danielson of the National Federation of the Blind about a law student who was barred from taking the bar exam and about electronic books and the screen reading programs. And at 11:30, the guest is Damian Platt, co-author of Culture is Our Weapon, Making Music and Changing Lives in Rio de Janeiro. All of this here on your community radio station, KBOO. You are listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott, and my co-host is Celeste Carey, and our guest this morning is Dar Jamal.
As we wrap this up, Dar, one of the things I want to go back again and revisit, because I really want our listeners to understand how devastating this is going to be for generations to come, and how little we know about what's going on, is the connection between what has happened with the exposure to radioactivity in terms of birth defects, both in Fallujah and here in the States. Now, in Iraq, if I recall correctly, most of the birth defects seem to be focused around Fallujah and not widespread, so that people can blame it on things such as post-traumatic stress of the mothers or inadequate nutrition or water issues, which are certainly issues in Iraq. But then you have returning vets here having children that are also showing the similar birth defects, and the foot dragging that's going on with the UN and the United States. What is being done to address that?
Well, it's actually the issue of cancer rates spiking. Fallujah is the most recent and obvious example in Iraq, but you know, all around Baghdad and towns south of there, like Bab al-Masriya, as far down as Basra, you know, still in the wake of the 90 Gulf War, where we started to see, in the wake of that, massive escalations of cancer rates. So, you know, childhood leukemia in the Basra area from 92 to 2000, for example, spiked 26-fold, not 26%, but 26-fold. In Fallujah, since 2004, 25% of newborn infants now have serious physical abnormalities. You know, this was basically not seen at all prior to the U.S. attacks in 2004. In Babel, an area just south of Baghdad, we saw 500 cancer cases in 2004. Last year, 9,000. So we're looking at these massive, massive spikes in cancer rates. And then, you know, coming back home, U.S. veterans who, you know, I've interviewed many, many soldiers from my recent book who said, yeah, I rode around in an M1 Abrams tank. The hull of the tank is coated in DU to prevent us from being blown up if we roll over a mine, because DU is extremely heavy and is effective at that. But we literally rode around sitting on DU, firing DU. Some of the shells we used were DU shells from our tanks. So, you know, no big shocker. These guys come home with serious, serious problems, and it's happening rampantly enough that it's even being referred to now as the Gulf War II syndrome, you know, playing on the Gulf War I syndrome, which most people believe a big component of those illnesses has been a widespread exposure to depleted uranium munitions. And then let's have a little perspective on this, for the fact that this is how grossly underreported this is and how serious of a problem this is. So, you know, the half-life, talk about the half-life of DU. Let's talk about how this story is not going to go away. For perspective, this planet is about 4.5 billion years old. That is the half-life of depleted uranium.
That's profound.
We're speaking with Jamal, and before we end our conversations this morning, I also want you to touch upon another underreported issue in addition to the effect of war. This is related to the role of women in Iraq. In a recent article, you and Abdul Rahman wrote an article about the women in Iraq and whether or not their situation is better or worse since Saddam. Could you say something about the role of women today in Iraq and their future?
Well, women in Iraq under Saddam, you know, Saddam was largely a secular dictator, and women's rights in Iraq then were comparable to women's rights in this country. They were certainly encouraged to go to school, get high-ranking positions in the government, become professionals, and they did all of these things. Not to say it was a bastion of women's rights in Iraq under Saddam, but compared certainly to other Middle Eastern countries, perhaps excepting Lebanon, it was. And yet then with the U.S. Occupation, and I spoke very clearly about how the U.S. has backed Maliki. Well, under Maliki, we saw a new Iraqi constitution arise that basically made Islam the official religion of the state and had enough gray areas in the constitution where laws were to be interpreted that way. And this had a profoundly deleterious effect on women who saw their personal status rights and other laws and things like them being able to file for divorce themselves, all that be basically completely taken away. And this is all, again, a direct result of the U.S. occupation, because let's keep in mind, this is an Iraqi constitution that was first written in English and then translated into Arabic.
Which in and of itself is just incredible. And so basically what we've got is a constitution that upholds the rule of Islam as the primary arbiter, so no law that contradicts Islam can be written or will be upheld. So anything that will advance women's opportunities to be self-determining is going to be challenged on those grounds, correct?
Well, exactly. And let's be clear, we're not talking about a secular version of Islam at all. We're obviously talking about a very conservative version of interpretation of Islamic law. And that's what we're looking at in Iraq, as opposed to a more secular Islam, as we saw under Saddam Hussein.
So to carry this to its possible conclusion, then, one of the things that we're looking at in Afghanistan is the fact that you have high infant mortality rate and women mortality rates while they're in childbirth because of the laws that prohibit women from even going out without a male accompanist, a chaperone, to doctors. You don't have enough female doctors to care for them, and so you're having an incredible spike in deaths there. Is this possibly what we'll be seeing out of Iraq?
It's certainly possible. It hasn't started to happen yet, although we are seeing other ways where that type of thing is happening, where in certain areas of the South where young women have tried to go to college, they've been beaten up, threatened, sometimes raped. So again, that is, things certainly seem to be heading in that direction, and I know many of the women in Baghdad. Several, one particular interpreter that I worked with said, you know, she was afraid to go out, and she certainly wasn't going to go out without her head covered. Whereas, again, prior to the occupation, these were never issues.
We've been speaking this morning with Dajah Moore, who is an independent journalist who has reported from Iraq for these 7 years, 7-8 years. He will be in Oregon, in Portland, as the keynote speaker for the Oregon Physician for Social Responsibility annual awards dinner on April 10th. And he is the author of Beyond the Green Zone and The Will to Resist. Mr. Jamal, thank you for being that sort of independent voice that many of us need to hear, that all of us need to hear. And if you could give us information about where people might read your articles, your website, perhaps.
Sure. And again, thank you very much for having me on your program. And folks can find all my articles on my website, which they can access by simply going to dahr.org, D-A-H-R.org.
Excellent. And we know this has been no small sacrifice for you. I was reading in your bio that you used to be a field guide up on Denali, and having spent a lot of time on Mount Denali myself, I can appreciate what a profound shift and sacrifice that was. Peace and quiet and beauty to the horrors of war.
Yeah, indeed it was. But, you know, I, as you know, up on Denali and anywhere outside, really, you know, you get a lot from, it's a lot of good energy from those places that I think enable us to go back out. But I certainly intend to actually go back to Denali sooner rather than later to kind of keep replenishing, so that, you know, as all of us know who've been covering these stories, you know, we have to, you know, find ways to make this sustainable.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for fighting the good fight.
Thank you both.
And you are listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. Find us online at www.kboo.fm. We want to thank anyone who has supported KBOO and anyone who is considering supporting KBOO. Go ahead and give in to that urge. Stay tuned and listen, because we have coming up the Old Mole Variety Hour and lots more here on Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland.